cave is empty but for Marcus, me, and the dozen masks who serve as Marcus's personal guard. The entire way I try to leash my rage. I must not act on it. As much as I hate them, they are the holy men of the Empire. Hurting one could lead to horrible consequences, and if something happens to me, then Livia and her son go unprotected. I curse myself. Even now, even when I loathe them, some part of me is still trained to respect them. The push and pull of it makes me sick to my stomach. Just get Marcus up there and let him do the talking. Don't engage. Don't ask questions. Don't let them say anything to you. Tell them you don't want to hear whatever it is they have to say. The storm that has raged all morning squats over the mountains, soaking us and turning the path to the Augur's home into a treacherous, slippery death trap. By the time we make our way across the wide rock bowl that leads to the cave, we are covered in mud and cuts, which puts Marcus in an even fouler mood than usual. The Augur's cave is dark, without a hint of life, and I briefly hold out hope that the seers will not allow us within. It is well known that they can keep out whomever they wish to. But as we approach the mouth of the cave, blue light flares, and a shadow detaches from the rock, red eyes visible even at a distance. When we draw closer, the shadow speaks. It is the same Augur who let me in last time.
"Emperor Marcus Farrar, Bloodshrike," she says. "You are welcome here. Your men, however, must remain behind."
Like the last time I came here, the Augur walks me down a long tunnel that glows sapphire from blue fire lamps. I grip my sims as I think back to that day.
"First you will be unmade. First you will be broken."
I was still Helene Aquila then. Now I am someone new. Though my mental shield didn't work against the Nightbringer, I use it anyway. If the red-eyed fiends want to root around in my head, they should at least know they aren't welcome. When we get deeper into the mountain, another Augur awaits us, one I cannot name. But from Marcus's sharp intake of breath, it's clear the Emperor knows her.
"Artan."
Marcus says the name the same way I snarl Cain's.
"Long have the Emperors of the Marshals come to the Augurs in times of need," Artan says. "You seek counsel, Emperor Marcus. I am honor-bound to offer it. Sit, please. I will speak with you."
She gestures to a low bench before clearing her throat and glancing at me.
"Alone."
The same woman who escorted us in takes my arm and guides me away. She does not speak as we walk. Distantly I hear the drip of water, and then what sounds like the ping of steel. It echoes again and again, a strange and incongruent tattoo. We enter a circular cavern, black gems glimmering along its walls, and Cain steps from the shadows. Without thinking, I reach for my blade.
"Nay, Shrike."
Cain lifts a withered hand, and my own freezes.
"There is no threat here."
I force my hand away from my sim, casting about for something, anything, to distract me from my rage. "What's that sound?" I say, of the strange ping, ping, ping. "It's irritating."
"Just the cave singing their stories," Cain says. "A few are filled with crystal, others with water. Many are as tiny as houses. Others are large enough to hold a city. But always, they sing. Some days we can hear the horns of the riverboats leaving Delphinium."
"Delphinium is hundreds of miles away," I say. "Bleeding hells. I knew there were caves and tunnels under the city, but I didn't know that the Augur's caves were so extensive. The land to the west of here is solid rock, the only caves inhabited by bears and wildcats. I assume the mountains to the east are the same." Cain watches me thoughtfully.
"You are much changed, Bloodshrike. Your thoughts are closed.
Satisfaction courses through me. I'll have to tell Harper.
Did the Meheria teach you, as he did the Faraz?
At my mystified look, Kane clarifies.
You refer to him as the Nightbringer.
No, I snap, and then, why do you call him Meheria? Is that his name?
His name, his history, his birthright, his curse. The truth of all creatures, man or djinn, lies in their name. The Nightbringer's name was his making, and it will be his unmaking.
He tilts his head.
Did you come to ask about the Nightbringer, Bloodshrike?
I have no desire to be here, I say. Marcus ordered my presence.
Ah, let us make civil conversation then. Your sister, she is well? Soon to be a mother, of course.
If the Commandant doesn't kill her first, I say, if she survives childbirth. And even though I do not wish to, I seek the answer to those questions in his eyes. I find nothing. He paces around the cave, and unwillingly I fall into step with him.
The tribespeople say that the heavens live under the feet of the mother, he says. So great is their sacrifice. And indeed, no one suffers in war more than the mother. This war will be no different.
Are you saying Livia is going to suffer? I want to shake the answer from him. She's safe now. Kane fixes me with his stare.
No one is safe. Have you not yet learned that lesson, Bloodshrike?
Though he sounds merely curious, I sense an insult in his words, and my fingers inch toward my warhammer.
You wish to cause me pain, Kane says. But already my every breath is torture. Long ago, I took something that did not belong to me, and I, and my kin, have spent every moment since paying for it.
At my utter lack of sympathy, he sighs.
Soon enough, Bloodshrike, he says, you will see my brethren and me brought low, and you shall need no hammer. Nor blade, for we shall undo ourselves. The time to atone for our sins approaches.
His attention shifts to the hallway behind me.
As it does for your emperor.
A moment later, Marcus appears, face grim. I nod a curt goodbye to Kane. I hope I never bleeding see him again. As we walk out of the tunnel and down to our men, clustered between boulders to escape the lashing rain, Marcus looks over at me.
You will be in charge of the defense of the city, Marcus says. I will tell the generals.
Most of them are far more seasoned than I am at dealing with marauding armies, my lord.
The strength of the butcher bird is the strength of the empire, for she is the torch against the night. Your line will rise or fall with her hammer. Your fate will rise or fall with her will.
When Marcus looks at me, I know for an instant how Kane must have felt when I looked at him. Pure hate radiates from the Emperor, and yet he is strangely diminished. He is not telling me everything the Augur said. Did the Augur say anything else?
That hag hasn't been wrong yet, Marcus says. Not about me. Not about you. So whether you like it or not, Shrike, Antium's defense is in your hands.
It is deep night by the time we approach the northern gates to the capital. Teams of plebeians fortify the walls, a legionnaire bellowing at them to work faster. The acrid reek of tar fills the air as soldiers lug buckets of it up ladders to the top of our defenses. Fletchers transport wagon loads of arrows, divided into tubs for the archers to grab easily. Though the moon is high, it seems as if there is not a single sleeping soul in the city. Vendors hawk food and ale, and scholar slaves carry water to those working. This will not last. When the Karkans come, The civilians will be forced to retreat into their homes to wait and see whether their brothers and fathers, uncles and cousins, sons and grandsons can hold the city. But in this moment, as all the people come together, unafraid, my heart swells. Come what may, I am glad I am here to fight with my people. And I am glad I am the Bloodshrike, charged with leading the marshals to victory. And I will lead them to victory, over the Karkans and the Commandant. Marcus appears to notice none of this. He is lost in thought, striding forward without looking at all those who labor for his empire. My lord, I say, perhaps take a moment to acknowledge the workers.
We have a bleeding war to plan, you fool.
Wars succeed or fail based on the men who fight them, I remind him. Take one moment. They will remember. He regards me with irritation, before breaking away from his men to speak with a group of orc soldiers. I watch from a distance, and from the corner of my eye I notice a group of children. One, a girl, wears a wooden silver-painted mask over her face as she fights a slightly smaller girl, who is presumably posing as a barbarian. The cluck of their wooden swords is just one more instrument in the frantic symphony of a city preparing for war. The masked girl spins under the other's sim before delivering a kick to her bottom and pinning her with a boot. I smile and she looks up, pulling off her mask hastily. She offers a clumsy salute. The other girl, who I realize must be a younger sister, stares open-mouthed.
Elbow up! I fix the girl's arm. Hand perfectly straight, and the tip of your middle finger should be at the center of your forehead. Keep your eyes on the space between you and me. Try not to blink too much.
When she's got it, I nod.
Good, I say. Now you look like a mask.
Chrissa says I'm not big enough.
She looks to her still-staring sister.
But I'm going to fight the Karkans when they come.
Then we'll surely defeat them. I look between the girls. Take care of each other, I say. Always. Promise me. As I walk away, I wonder if they will remember the vow they made me 10 years from now, 20. I wonder if they'll still be alive. I think of Livy, far away, I hope. Safe. That fact is the only thing that gives me comfort. We will defeat Grimmar's army. We are the superior fighting force. But the warlock is a clever adversary, and it will be a hard battle. Skies know what will happen in that chaos. Cain's words haunt me.
No one is safe.
Curse the Commandant for bringing this upon us out of her greed. Curse her for caring more about becoming Empress than about the Empire she seeks to rule. Marcus shouts at me to get moving. When we return to the palace, it is a hive of activity. Horses, men, weaponry, and wagons clog the gates as the palace guards sandbag the outer walls and hammer in planks across the entrance gates. With so many people coming in and out, it will be difficult to keep the place secure against the Commandant's spies and her assassins. Come for Marcus, Karras, I think. Do my work for me, but you'll never get your hands on my sister or her child again. Not while I live and breathe. As we approach the throne room, there's a buzz in the air. I think one of the courtiers whispers Karras's name, but Marcus walks too fast for me to linger and listen. The throne room doors fly open as Marcus strides toward them. A sea of illustrian nobles mills within, waiting to hear what the Emperor will say about the approaching army. I feel no fear in the air, only a grim sense of determination and a strange tension, as if everyone knows a secret they aren't willing to share. The source of it becomes apparent moments later, as the waves of illustrians part to reveal a small blonde woman in bloodied armor, standing beside a tall, equally blonde woman, heavy with child. The Commandant has returned to Antium, and she has brought my sister with her.
Chapter 42. Liar. The day Mother gave me her armlet, I was 5. Nan's curtains were drawn. I could not see the moon. Pop must have been there. Darren, Liss, and Father too. But I remember Mother's crooked smile most clearly. Her lapis eyes and long fingers. I sat in her lap, trying to tuck my cold feet into her warm shirt. "You're not Liar," she'd said. "You're an Ifrit of the North, trying to turn me into an icicle." Someone called out to her. "Time to go." She whispered to me to keep the armlet safe. Then she wrapped her arms around me, and though she squeezed too tightly, I did not care. I wanted to pull her into me. I wanted to keep her. "We will see each other again." She kissed my hands, my forehead. "I swear it."
"When?"
"Soon." The courtyard gate creaked as she slipped through it. She smiled back at me and Darren, huddled between our grandparents. Then she stepped into the night, and the darkness swallowed her up. I reel from what the Nightbringer showed me, from the crawling feeling of him and his kin all over my mind. I hold the armlet Elias gave me, and I do not let go. I'm free of the djinn now. As I stumble away from the forest, as the voices of the ghosts peak, I move more swiftly. The dead will rise, and none can survive. Shaver's prophecy rings in my mind. Something has gone terribly wrong within the waiting place, and I need to get as far away as possible. I run, trying to remember again what I meant to do, trying to get the Nightbringer's voice out of my head. Musa marked a village on my map. I must get there, meet his contact, and get to Antium. But before then, I need to pull the shards of my mind off the ground and put them back together. I cannot change what is done. I can only move forward and hope to the skies that before I meet Cook again, I've made my peace with what she did to Father and Liss, with what she endured, with what she sacrificed for the resistance. I make my way northwest. A pair of hills rises a few miles ahead, with a dip in the middle that should shelter the village of Myrtium. Musa's contact is meant to await me there. Since it's martial territory, I should use my magic to become invisible. But I cannot bear the thought of more visions, of seeing more pain and suffering. I cannot bear the thought of seeing her. I think of Darren. Did he know about what Mother did? Is that why he tensed up every time I spoke of her? I wish to the skies that he was here now. Rattled though I may be, I have the wits to wait until dark before I creep toward the village proper. The summer night is warm, the only noise a gentle breeze blowing in off a nearby creek. I feel louder than a horse with bells on as I slink along the walls. The inn is the central building in the village, and I watch for a long time before getting closer. Musa told me little of his contact, for fear that the knowledge could be extracted by our enemies if I am caught. But I know that he is not a marshal, and that he will be waiting within the inn, by the fire. I am to cloak myself, whisper to him that I've arrived, and then follow his instructions. He will take me to the Mariner Embassy in Antium, where I'll get maps of the palace and the city, information about the Bloodshrike, and where she will be. Everything I'll need to get in, get the ring, and get the hells out. Gold light spills out into the streets from the inn's wide, rounded windows, and the tap room is full with agitated conversation drifting out in bits.
"If the strike can't stop them, how the bleeding hells is she supposed to stop them with only... City will never be taken. Those pigs don't know how to fight."
I keep to the shadows, trying to see into the inn from across the street. It is impossible. I must get closer. The inn has a series of smaller side windows, and the alleys around it are quiet, so I skitter across the square, hoping no one sees me, and climb onto a crate, peeking through one of the windows. It offers a decent view of the room, but so far, everyone here is a marshal. I peer past the barkeep, through the thicket of serving maids pouring out drinks and lads delivering plates of food. The long bar is crowded with villagers, all of whom seem to be talking at once. How the hells am I supposed to find him in this mess? I'll have to cloak myself in invisibility. I have no choice.
Hello, girl.
I nearly jump out of my skin. When the hooded figure appears behind me, when her voice rasps a greeting, all I can think is that the Nightbringer has somehow followed me here, to this tiny village, that he is playing more tricks on my mind. But the figure steps forward and lowers her hood to reveal moon-white hair that never belonged on her, and midnight blue eyes too shadowed to be familiar, and violently scarred skin that I never noticed was unwrinkled until now. Her fingers are stained a deep, strange Titian. Her diminutive height disorients me. All these years, I thought she was tall.
Girl.
I reach out a hand to touch her, and she shies away. How can this be real? How can I be staring into Mother's face after so long? But of course, it is real. And the Nightbringer somehow knew she would be waiting. Why else torment me with her true identity? He could have shown me who she was weeks ago, any time I used my invisibility. But he didn't, because he knew this is when it would hit me the hardest. Part of me wants to run to her, feel her hands on my skin, hold them in my own. I wish Darin were here. I wish Izzy were here. But the part of me that thinks Mother is stifled to silence by the darker part of me that screams, liar. I want to shout and curse at her and ask her every question that has plagued me since the moment I learned who she is. Understanding dawns on her face. Who told you? Her cold eyes are unfamiliar. Can't have been Musa. He doesn't know. No one does. Except Kerris, of course. The Nightbringer, I whisper. The Nightbringer told me who you are. Who I was. She draws up her hood and turns to the darkness. Come, we'll talk on the way. Marrow-deep panic grips me when she turns from me. Don't leave. I want to follow her. And at the same time, I never want to see her again. I'm not going anywhere with you, I say, until you tell me what the hell's happened to you. Why didn't you say anything at Blackcliff? You slaved for Kerris for years. How could you? She clenches and unclenches her fists, just like Darin when he is upset. I dip my head, but she will not meet my stare. Her face twitches, her mouth curving into a grimace. Listen to me, girl, she says. We have to go. You have a mission, do you not? Don't bleeding forget it. The mission. The mission. How can you? I throw up my hands and walk past her. I'll make my own way. I don't need you. I don't. But after only a few steps, I turn back. I cannot leave her. I missed her for so many years. I have longed for her from the age of 5, when she was taken from me. We've a long road ahead. Nothing about how she speaks sounds like the mother I knew. This is not the woman who called me cricket, or tickled me until I couldn't breathe, or promised me she'd teach me how to shoot a bow as well as she did. Whoever she is now, she is Mira of Sarah, no longer. There will be plenty of time for you to scream at me on the way. I'd welcome it. Her scarred mouth lifts in a sneer. But we cannot delay. The blood strike is in Antium. And Antium is where we must go. But if we don't hurry, we'll never get inside. No, I whisper to her. We settle this first. This is more important. And in any case, you must have a dozen ways of sneaking in.
I do,
Cook says. But there are tens of thousands of Karkins marching on the capital. And all the sneaking in the world won't do us a whit of good if they surround the city before we get there.
Chapter 43 The Bloodstrike. Farris and Raelius are both pale as ghosts when I meet them in Livia's quarters, rattled by what they have just survived, each bleeding from a dozen wounds. I have no time to coddle them. I need to know what the hell's happened out there, and how Karras got the best of us again.
It was a Karkan attack.
Farris paces back and forth across Livia's sitting room, while her women settle her in her bedroom.
200 of those woad loving demons. They came out of bleeding nowhere. They were waiting.
Raelius growls as he ties off a bandage on his leg.
Maybe not for the Empress specifically, but for an opportunity, certainly. If Karras hadn't shown up with her men, we'd have been in a bad spot.
If Karras hadn't shown up, I say in irritation, Grimmar and his hordes wouldn't have either. She's working with them. She did this so she could get to Livia. Thank the skies for you and the other masks. She must have realized she couldn't kill you all, so she decided to play the hero instead. Devious, true, but just like the Commandant. She is always adaptable. And now the plebeians in the city are hailing her as a hero for saving the life of the half-plebeian heir, as she probably knew they would. Go clean up, I say. Triple the watch around the Empress. I want her food tasted a day in advance. I want one or the other of you present when it is prepared. She doesn't leave the palace. If she wants to get out, she can take a walk in the gardens. The men leave, and I go over and over what they have said as I await the arrival of Dex, whom I sent to get Livia's midwife. When he finally returns, after hours, it is with a different woman from the one I'd personally chosen to tend to Livia.
The first one is gone, Shrike,
Dex tells me as the new midwife bustles into Livia's rooms.
Left the city, apparently, along with every other midwife I tried to track down. This one only came because she's a mariner. Whomever the hell's Karras Veturia sent to frighten all those women probably didn't have a chance to get to her.
I curse, keeping my voice low. Karras saved my sister from the Karkans because it suited her needs. The plebeians sing her praises. Now she'll seek to kill Livia quietly. Plenty of women die in childbirth, especially if they are delivering without a midwife. What of the barracks' physicians? Surely one of them can deliver a baby.
They know battlefield wounds, Shrike, not childbirth. That's what midwives are for, apparently.
Their words.
Dex winces at my wrath. Not mine.
The new midwife, a skinny mariner with gentle hands and a booming voice that would put any martial drill sergeant to shame, smiles at Livia, asking her a series of questions.
Keep this one alive, Dex, I murmur. I don't care if you have to put a dozen guards on her and live with her in the Blackguard barracks. You keep her alive and find a backup. This cannot possibly be the only midwife left in the entire city. He nods, and though I've dismissed him, I notice his reluctance to leave.
Out with it, Atreus.
The plebeians, he says. You've heard that they're rising in support of the Commandant.
Well, it's gotten worse.
How the hells could it get worse?
The story about her murdering the highborn Illustrians who wronged her has been making the rounds, Dex says. The Paters are infuriated, but the plebeians are saying that Karras stood up to those more powerful than her. They're saying that she defended a plebeian man she loved, that she fought for one and took rightful vengeance. They're saying the Illustrians who died got what they deserved.
Hells. If the Commandant now has plebeian support instead of Illustrian, I haven't hurt her at all. I've just managed to shuffle her list of allies.
Let the rumor play, I say. At Dex's nod, I sigh. We'll have to find another way to undermine her.
At that moment, the midwife pokes her head out, gesturing me into Livia's quarters.
Hey, strong as a bull!
She beams at me, patting Livia's belly with affection.
He'll bruise a rib or two before he joins us. I'd bet my life on it. But the Empress is doing fine, as is the child. A few weeks more, lass, and you'll be holding your precious babe in your arms.
Should we do anything for her? Some sort of tea, or... I realize I sound like an idiot. Teas, Shrike? Truly?
Gold rose petals and goat's milk every morning until her own milk comes in, the midwife says,
and wildwood tea twice a day. When the woman is finally gone, Livy sits up, and I am surprised to see a knife clutched in her hands.
Have her killed, she whispers.
I raise an eyebrow. The midwife? What? Gold rose petals, Livy says, are used when a woman is past her due date. They're meant to make a baby come more quickly. I'm still a few weeks away. It wouldn't be safe for him to come now. I call Dex in immediately. When he leaves, weapons in hand, Livia shakes her head. This is Karis, isn't it? All of it. The car can attack, the midwife's leaving, this midwife. I'll stop her, I vow to my sister. I don't expect you to believe it, because all I've done is fail, but... No. Livia takes my hand. We don't turn on each other, Hel, Shrike. No matter what happens. And yes, we must stop her. But we must also keep the support of the plebeians. If they support Karis now, you cannot speak against her publicly. You must walk that line, sister. We cannot put this child on the throne if the plebeians don't see him as one of their own. And they won't. Not if you cross Karis. Evening sees me in Marcus's war room, locked in an argument with the paters, wanting nothing more than to beat all of them into silence before doing what I wish. General Caecilius, who is turning out to be as irritating as his twisted uncle, the warden, paces before the large map laid out on the table, stabbing at it occasionally.
If we send a small force to stop Grimar, he says, we are wasting good men on a lost cause. It's a suicide mission. How can 500, even 1,000 men, stand against a force 100 times that?
Avitas, who has joined me in the war room, gives me a look. Don't lose your temper, the look says. If we send a large force, I say, for the 1,000th time, we leave Antium vulnerable. Without the legions from Estium and Silas, we have only 6 legions to hold the city. Reinforcements from the tribal lands, or Navium, or Tiberium, would take more than a month to reach here. We must send a smaller attack force to cause as much damage as possible. It's such a basic tactic that at first I am stunned that Caecilius and a few of the other paters resist so much. Until I realize, of course, that they are using this opportunity to undermine me, and, by extension, Marcus. They might not trust the Commandant anymore, but that doesn't mean they want Marcus on the throne. For his part, the Emperor's attention is fixed on Karis Veturia. When he does finally look at me, I can read his expression as clearly as if he shouted the words, "Why is she here, Shrike? Why is she still alive?" Those hyena eyes of his flare, promising pain for my sister, and I look away.
Why is the Shrike leading the force? Pater Rufius demands of me. Would not Karis Veturia be a better choice? I do not know if you understand this, my Lord Emperor, but it is highly...
His sentence ends in a yelp as Marcus casually flings a throwing knife at him, missing him by a hair. The sound of Rufius's squeal is deeply satisfying.
Speak to me like that again, Marcus says, and you'll find yourself without a head. Karis was barely able to hold Navium's harbor against the barbarian fleet.
Avitas and I exchange a glance. This is the first time the Emperor has dared to say a word against the Commandant.
The Shrike, Marcus goes on, took back the harbor and saved thousands of plebeian lives. The decision is made. The Shrike will lead the force against the Karkans.
But, my lord...
Marcus's giant hand is around Rufius's throat so fast that I almost didn't see him move.
Go on, the Emperor says softly. I'm listening.
Rufius gasps his apology, and Marcus drops him. The pater scurries away, a rooster who has escaped the stew pot. The Emperor turns to me.
A small force, Shrike. Strike and run. Take no prisoners. And do not waste our forces if you don't have to. We'll need every last man for the assault on the city.
From the corner of my eye, I notice Karis watching me. She nods a greeting, the first time she has acknowledged me since returning to Antium with my sister. My spine tingles in warning. That look on her face, cunning, calculated. I saw it as a student at Blackliff, and I saw it months ago, here in Antium, before Marcus killed my family. I know that look now. It is the look she gets when she's about to spring a trap. Arvatas arrives in my office just after the sun has set. All is prepared, Shrike, he says. The men will be ready to leave at dawn. Good. I pause and clear my throat. Harper, perhaps Bloodshrike, Arvatas says. You are considering telling me that I should not go, that I should remain here to keep an eye on our enemies and to remain close to the Emperor, should he need it. I open and close my mouth, taken aback. That was exactly what I was going to suggest. Forgive me. Arvatas looks tired, I notice. I've been leaning on him too much. But that is exactly what the Commandant would expect. She is, perhaps, counting on it. Whatever she has planned, you surviving isn't a part of it. And you have a much better chance of surviving if you have someone who knows her, watching your back. What the hells is she up to, I say. Beyond just trying to take the throne, I mean. I've reports that a man of Gens Veturia was seen at the Hall of Records. She's had the paters of the three biggest Illustrian Gens over to her villa in the few hours she's been back. She even had the Master of the Treasury over. She killed that man's son and tattooed her triumph onto her own body, Harper. It was 10 years ago, but she still did it. Those men should hate her. Instead, they are breaking bread with her. She's wooing them back to her side, Harper says. She's trying to rattle you. You took her by surprise in Navium. She won't be taken by surprise again, which is why I should come with you. At my hesitation, impatience sparks on his face. Use your head, Shrike. She had Captain Alistair poisoned. She had Favorous poisoned. She got to the Bleeding Empress. You're not immortal. She can get to you too. Be smart about this for the love of skies. We need you. You cannot play into her hands. I don't consider my next words. They just come out. Why do you care so much what happens to me? Why do you think? His words are sharp, lacking his usual care. And when his green eyes meet mine, they are angry. But his voice is cool. You are the Bloodshrike. I am your second. Your safety is my duty. Sometimes, Arvatas, I sigh, I wish you'd say what you're actually thinking. Come along on the raid, then, I say, and at his look of surprise I roll my eyes. I'm not a fool, Harper. Let's keep her on her toes. There's something else. A worry has grown in my mind, something no general would publicly speak of before a battle, but something I must consider, especially after talking to Livia of the Plebeians. Do we have exit routes mapped out of the city? Paths through which we could move large groups of people? I'll dig them up. Do it before we leave, I say. Give orders, quietly, to make sure those paths are clear, and that we protect them at all costs. You think we cannot hold back the Karkans? I think that if they're in league with Karis, it is foolish to underestimate them. We might not know what she's playing at, but we can prepare for the worst. We move out the next morning, and I force Karis and her machinations from my mind. If I can rout Grimmar's forces, or at least weaken them, before they get to Antium, she'll lose her chance to take Marcus down, and I'll be the hero instead of her. The Karkans are 12 days from the city, but my force can move faster than theirs. My men and I have 5 days to make life as hellish as possible for them. Our smaller force allows us to ride swiftly, and on the evening of the 3rd day, our scouts confirm that the Karkan force has, as Dex reported, gathered at Umbral Pass. They have Tundaran wildmen with them. That's likely how Grimmar figured out the way through. Those women-hating Tundaran bastards know these mountains almost as well as the marshals do. Why the hells are they just waiting there? I ask Dex. They should be clear of the pass by now, and out into open country.
Waiting for more men, perhaps, Dex says, though their force doesn't seem much bigger than when I saw it.
I send my cousin Baristus out to recon the north end of the pass to see if, indeed, more Karkans are joining the main body of the army. But when he returns, he brings only questions.
Blading strange, sir, Baristus says.
As Dex, Avitas, and I gather in my tent, my cousin paces back and forth, agitated.
There are no more men coming in through the northern passes. Truly, it appears they are waiting. But for what, I cannot tell. I thought it might be weaponry or artillery for their siege machines. But they have no siege machines. How the bleeding hells do they plan to get past the walls of Antium without catapults?
Maybe Karis promised to let them in, I say, and they don't yet realize how devious she is. It would be just like her to play both sides.
And then what? Dex says. She lets them lay siege for a few weeks?
Enough time for her to find a way to get Marcus killed in the fighting, I say. Enough time for her to sabotage the birth of my nephew. Ultimately, it is the Empire that Karis wishes to rule over. She will not let the capital of the Empire fall. But the loss of a few thousand lives? That's nothing to her. I've learned that lesson well.
If we rout the Karkans here, I say, then we kill her plan before it draws its first breath.
I examine the drawings the Orcs has given me of the layout of the Karkan army camp. Their food stores, their weaponry, the locations of their various provisions. They've buried their most valuable goods in the very heart of the army, where they will be almost impossible to reach. But I have masks with me, and the word impossible has been whipped and beaten out of us. My force strikes deep in the night, when much of the Karkan camp is sleeping. The sentries go down swiftly, and Dex leads a force that is in and out before the first flames rise from the Karkan food stores. We hit perhaps a sixth of their supply, but by the time our enemies sound the alarm, we have retreated back into the mountains.
I'll come with you for the next assault, Shrike, Harper says to me as we prepare for another. Something feels wrong to me. They took that attack lying down.
Perhaps it's because we surprised them. Harper paces nervously, and I put a hand on his shoulder to still him. A spark jumps between us, and he looks up in surprise. Immediately I let him go.
I need you with the rear guard, I say to cover my awkwardness. If something does go wrong, I'll need you to get the men back to Antium.
Our next assault comes just before dawn, when the barbarians are still scrambling from our earlier attack. This time I lead a group of 100 men, armed with arrows and flame. But almost before the first volley flies, it is clear that the Karkans are ready for us. A wave of more than 1,000 of them on our western side breaks off from the main army and surges upward in orderly, organized lines that I've never seen in a Karkan force. But we have the higher ground, so we pick off as many as we can. They have no horses, and these mountains are not their land. They don't know these hills the way we do. When we've exhausted our arrows, I signal the retreat, which is when the unmistakable thud of a drum thunders out from the rear guard. Arvatus's troops. One deep thud. Two. Three. Ambush. We worked out the warnings ahead of time. I spin about, my warhammer in hand, waiting for the attack. The men close ranks. A hoarse screams, a chilling and unmistakable sound. Curses ring out when the drum sounds again. But this time, the drum is unceasing, a frantic call for aid.
The rear guard is under attack, Dex calls out. How the hell's...
His sentence ends in a grunt as he parries a knife that comes flying out at him from the woods. And then we can think of nothing but surviving, because we are suddenly surrounded by Karkans. They rise up from well-hidden traps in the ground, drop down from trees, rain down arrows and blades and fire. From the rear guard we hear the unholy howling of more Karkans as they pour down the mountain from the east. Thousands of them. More still approach from the north. Only the south is clear. But not for long, if we don't clear this ambush. We're dead. We're bleeding dead. That ravine! I point to a narrow path between the closing pincer of the approaching forces, and we make a break for it, sending arrows back over our shoulders. The ravine follows the river, leading down to a waterfall. There are boats there, enough to take the remaining men downstream. Faster! They're closing! We run full force, grimacing at the screams of the rear guard dying swiftly as they are inundated by our enemy. Skies! So many men. So many black guards. And Arvatas is up there. Something feels wrong to me. If he'd been with us, he might have seen the ambush. We might have retreated before the Karkans attacked the rear guard. And now, I look up the mountain. He could not possibly survive that onslaught. None of them could. There are too many. He never told Elias that they are brothers. He never got to speak to Elias as a brother. And Skies, the things I've said to him in moments of rage, in anger, when all he did was try to help keep me alive. That spark between us, extinguished before I could put a name to it. My eyes burn. Shrike! Dex screams, and knocks me to the ground as an arrow cuts through the air, nearly impaling me. We scramble up and stumble on. The ravine finally appears, an 8-foot drop into the remnants of a creek. A hail of arrows comes down as we approach it. Shields! I shout. Steel thunks on wood, and then my men and I run again, years of training pushing us into neat rows. Every time a soldier is picked off, another moves to take his place, so that when I look back, I can count almost exactly how many are left. Only 75 of the 500 Marcus sent. We hurtle down the path beside the falls, and the thunder of the water drives away any other sound. The path curves back and forth on itself until it drops into a dusty flat where a dozen longboats are beached. The men need no orders. We hear the chants of the Karkans behind us. One boat launches, then another and another. Shrike! Dex pulls me toward a boat. You have to go! Not until the rest of the boats launch, I say. 425 men. Gone. And Arvatas. Gone. Skies, it was so quick. The sounds of swords clashing echoes from the path above. My hammer is in my hand, and I am racing up the path. If some of my men are still up there, then by the skies I will not let them fight alone. Shrike, no! Dex groans, draws his sim, and follows. Just beyond the entrance to the path, we find a group of marshals, three masks among them, battling the Tundarans, but been inexorably shoved back by the sheer number of them. A group of orcs supports a fourth mask, blood pouring from his neck, from a wound in his gut, from another in his thigh. Harper. Dex grabs him from the orcs, staggering under his weight as he carries him down toward the last boat. The orcs arm their bows and fire over and over until the air is buzzing with arrows, and it is a miracle I am not hit. One of the masks turns. It is Baristus, my cousin. "We'll hold them off," he shouts. "Go, Shrike! Warn the city! Warn the Emperor! Tell them there's another!" And then Dex is dragging me away, shoving me down the path and into the boat, sharking through the water as he pushes off. "Tell them what?" I want to scream. Dex rows with all his might, and the boat is through the falls and moving swiftly down the fast-flowing river. I kneel beside Harper. His blood is everywhere. If it weren't me in this boat beside him, he would be dead in a matter of minutes. I take his hand. If it weren't for Baristus's sacrifice, we'd all be dead. I expect to search for Harper's song. He is the consummate mask, his thoughts and emotions buried so deeply that I assumed his song would be equally opaque. But his song is near the surface. Strong and bright and clear as a star-filled winter sky. I delve into his essence. I see the smile of a dark-haired woman with wide-set green eyes, his mother, and the strong hands of a man who looks strikingly similar to Elias.
Harper walks Blackcliff's dark halls and endures day after day of the hardship and loneliness I know so well. He aches for his father, a mysterious figure who haunts him with an emptiness he can never quite fill. He is an open book, and I learn that he did set Lyra free months ago when we ambushed her. He set her free because he knew I would kill her, and he knew Elias would never forgive me for it. I witness myself through his eyes, angry and cold and weak and strong and brave and warm. Not the Bloodshrike. Helene. And I would be blind not to see what he feels for me. I am woven into his consciousness, the way Elias used to be woven into mine. Harper is always aware of where I am, of whether I am all right. When his wounds have closed and his heart beats strong, I stop singing, weakened. Dex looks at me with a wild, questioning expression, but says nothing. I adjust Harper's head so he is more comfortable, and his eyes open. I am about to scold him, but his harsh whisper silences me.
Grimmar and the men who hit the rear guard came from the east, Shrike, he rasps, determined to deliver the message. He attacked me. Would have killed me.
All the more reason to hate that swine. They must have snuck around us somehow, I say, or perhaps they were waiting.
No!
Avitas grabs a strap on my armor.
They came from the east. I sent a scout because I had a hunch. There's another force. They split their army, Shrike. They don't have just 50,000 men marching on Antium. They have twice that.
Chapter 44 Lyra.
At first, I don't know what to say to Cook. Mother, Mira. I watch her with wild eyes, part of me desperate to understand her story, and the other part wanting to scream out the pain of a dozen years without her until she throbs with it. Perhaps, I think to myself, she will wish to talk, to explain why she survived, how she survived. I do not expect her to justify what she did in the prison. She's not aware that I know of it, but I hope she will tell me why she kept her identity hidden. I hope she will at least apologize for it. Instead, she is silent, all her thought bent on moving swiftly across the countryside. Her face, her profile are burned into me. I see her in a thousand ways, even if she doesn't see herself. I find myself drawn to her. She was gone for so many years, and I do not wish to hold on to my anger. I do not want a fight with her like the one I had with Darin. On the first night we traveled together, I sit down beside her by the fire. What did I hope for? Perhaps for the woman who called me Cricket and rested her hand on my head, heavy and gentle. The woman whose smile was a flash in the dark, the last joyful thing I could remember for years. But the moment I get close, she clears her throat and shifts away from me. It's only a few inches, but I understand her meaning. In her rasping voice, she asks me about Izzy and about what has happened to me since I left Blackcliff. Part of me doesn't want to answer. You don't deserve to know. You don't deserve to have my story. But the other part, the part that sees a broken woman where my mother once lived, is not so cruel. So I tell her of Izzy, of her sacrifice, of my foolhardiness. I tell her of the Nightbringer, of Keenan and how he betrayed not just me, but our entire family. What must she think of me, to have fallen in love with the creature whose deceit led to those dark days in Koff Prison? I wait for her judgment, but she offers none. Instead she nods, her hands curled into fists, and disappears into the dark night. In the morning, she says nothing of it. For the next few nights, every time I so much as move, she flinches, as if worried I will come closer. So I stay far away from her, always on the other side of the fire, always a few yards behind her on the road. My mind churns, but I do not speak. It is as if her silence chokes me. But finally, the words will no longer stay down, and I find that I must say them, whatever the consequences. Why didn't you kill her? The night is warm, and we don't light a fire, instead laying out our bedrolls and looking up at the stars. The Commandant. You could have poisoned her, stabbed her. For sky's sake, your mirror of Sarah. There is no mirror of Sarah. Cook shrieks so loudly that a pack of sparrows takes flight from a nearby tree, as frightened as I am. She's dead. She died in Koff prison when her child and husband died. I'm not Mira. I'm Cook. And you will not speak to me of that murderous, traitorous bitch, or what she would or wouldn't do. You know nothing of her. She breathes heavily, her dark eyes sparkling with rage. I tried, girl, she hisses at me. The first time I attacked Karis, she broke my arm and lashed Izzy to within an inch of her life. The child was 5. I was forced to watch. The next time I got it in my head to try something, the bitch of Blackcliff took out Izzy's eye. Why not escape? You could have gotten out of there. I tried. But the chances Karis would catch us were too high. She'd have tortured Izzy, and I'd had enough of people suffering for me. Perhaps Mira of Sarah would have been willing to sacrifice a child to save her own neck. But that's because Mira of Sarah had no soul. Mira of Sarah was as evil as the Commandant. And I'm not her. Not anymore.
You haven't asked about Nan and Pop, I whisper. Or about Darin. I don't deserve to know how your brother is, she says.
As for your grandparents, her mouth splits into a small smile I do not recognize.
I had vengeance on their killer.
The mask, I say. How?
I hunted him. He wanted to die in the end. I was merciful.
Her eyes are black as dead coals.
You're judging me.
I wanted to kill him too,
but I enjoyed it. And that makes me evil. Come now, girl. You cannot walk in the shadows as long as I have, and not become one.
I shift uncomfortably, remembering what the Jarduna said to me. You are young to stand so deeply in the shadow.
I am glad you killed him.
I pause, considering my next words. But in the end, there is no delicate way to ask the question.
Why? Why won't you touch me? Don't you
long for it, I want to say. The way I do?
The touch of a child brings a mother comfort.
I can barely hear her.
But I'm no mother, girl. I'm a monster. Monsters don't merit comfort.
She turns away from me and falls silent. I watch her back for a long time. She's so close. Close enough to touch. Close enough to hear whispered words of forgiveness.
But I do not think that she would feel the embrace of a daughter
if I touched her. And I do not think she would care about being forgiven. The closer we get to Antium, the clearer it is that trouble is nigh. Cartloads of carpets and furniture trundle away from the city, their owners surrounded by dozens of guards. Once we see a heavily armed caravan from afar. I cannot see what they carry, but I count at least a dozen, masks guarding whatever it is.
They're running, Cook spits. Too scared to stay and fight. Mostly Illustrians, it seems. Move faster, girl. If the wealthy flee the city, the Karkans must be close.
We do not stop now, traveling day and night. But by the time we reach the outskirts of Antium, it is clear that disaster has already struck the Marshal's fabled capital. We hike over a ridge near the Argent Hills, and the city comes into view below. as does the enormous army that surrounds it on three sides. Only the north end of Antium, which abuts the mountains, is protected. Sweet bleeding sky.